Welcome back to Extra Features Interview. Today we have a fabulous guest all the way from Vancouver, Canada. Yes, I have a Canadian on my show. I'm very excited talking to Canadians. They don't seem to like me for some reason, but I am Canadian, so I don't understand why. Ross Monroe was here with his great film, A Legacy of Whining. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hey, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, where does this character come from? I need to know, because I want to punch him in the face most times, often than not.
Oh, I can see I did my job well. But, well, you know what? I basically started from the premise of a buddy movie. And usually, sometimes in a buddy movie, you usually have those two people that are the polar opposites. So I thought, you know what? I'm really influenced by The Odd Couple. And I kind of wanted to go that Felix Unger route, the sort of neurotic, insecure, but at the same time trying to project that you know a lot about a lot of stuff. So, and hence the title, A Legacy of Whining. I wanted to make sure that that particular character lived up to that title.
Now, why doesn't Duncan clock him earlier?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. Like, I get a lot of interesting reactions about that relationship. And it's, all I can think of is, like, sometimes, you know, when you grow up with people, it's amazing the kind of behavior, even in, well into adulthood, because you went through that as a child or an adolescent, like the kind of behavior that you can kind of tolerate when it's somebody, like if you met somebody in your 40s and they showed the kind of irritating traits that Mitch shows, you would blow that person off after a while, or like you say, you clock them or whatever. But somehow, you know, when you come up from a relationship from childhood or whatever, and it goes in adulthood, it's just amazing the kind of behavior you're willing to tolerate somehow, you know, because it's so ingrained or something.
Yeah, but you haven't seen each other in 30 years, the two characters.
Yes.
What took them so long to connect? Like, they're supposed to be such good buddies. At least Mitch thinks they are. And I don't get that feeling from Duncan at all. I think he just needs a getaway.
Yeah, you know, I kind of feel like it's I didn't really want to sort of a backstory per se. I don't know if that's because I just didn't, you know, want to really how much effort it would take me to go that way, or just the idea that I kind of like the idea that probably everybody has a friend or somebody they know that they from social media now that's made it a lot easier to kind of resurrect these people from the past. And I think that I just kind of like the idea of it being sort of like open-ended, just assuming that they were friends surprisingly, there were some people I was really good friends with in high school that once I moved away from that city, surprisingly, like, it was quite easy to kind of, like, just lose touch with people. And then when you connect later through social media, 25 years later or 20 years later, you kind of rekindle, you know, some of the things or some of those feelings you had for them, or whether they're good or bad ones. So, I think I just wanted to keep the relationship, like just the history of relationship, just kind of keep it open-ended, and maybe people could just impose their own thoughts on what their relationship could have been, why they didn't see each other for 30 years.
I just thought it was strange because, I mean, I want to talk about your black and white scenes, because I think you really try to force they are friends there, and they do have a sing, song and dance routine.
Yeah.
I mean, that must come or originate from somewhere, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, no, you're right, and I think part of it was I think I wanted to show the character of Mitch that I play. I wanted to show him as constantly like a dreamer about everything, and one of the things he could be constantly in this sort of state of denial about is you know, they obviously were friends at some point, you know, obviously, but I also wanted to kind of create the idea that probably in Mitch's mind, they were much more of this dynamic duo and had this really amazing friendship, probably in his mind, way more... that's way more his idea, his fantasy, and the other character, Dunk. I just wanted to make him almost cynically, like, the opposite in terms of being totally grounded, almost cynical, sarcastic, and very realistic, almost too realistic about everything. And so that's, I think, part of it was, and with the fantasies that you know you're alluding to, the black and white scenes, a lot of it I wanted to show that a lot of this. This amazing relationship that they had was more built up in his mind, probably as a fantasy.
Well, I know you wrote the film, so I will argue that. I think they were for a good friends. I just think they lost touch.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're right. I mean, I did want them to definitely be friends and then just, and maybe not so much that in Mitch's mind that you know, that, you know, I wanted maybe to be a little bit more like he was looking so forward to the reunion that he was willing to make see everything through rose-tinted glasses or whatever.
That's oh, I think so, definitely. Now, I did want to ask, is this based on a true story of any kind?
No, you know what? Other than the fact that, you know, I am an actor, and, you know, and, like, my it's an exaggerated version of some of the auditions. Like, one of the things about Mitch was I wanted to make him a very insecure, mostly out-of-work actor. And so I did really was able to channel a lot of my experiences and what I felt like it was like to be an actor, to go through all these sort of auditions, like these casting calls and being in a room with all these nervous actors and sort of feeling kind of disrespected with the process, that it was a very disembodied process of going through auditions sometimes, like a real cattle call. So other than that, that trying to take my experiences, you know, that I went through as an actor and maybe in an exaggerated comical way impose them on the character of Mitch. The idea, it's really not based on any particular experiences from my life, really.
Okay, so we're going to discuss, you're an actor, so I'm going to discuss one scene. It's right near the end. Mitch gets to his audition.
Right.
I don't think I'm ruining anything.
No problem.
I mean, it's not really a big, it's just the end. Did that actually happen to you, that scene?
That scene didn't happen to me specifically. It's more, I think, like impressionistically to me. Like, that's how I feel sometimes. I did do some auditions where, you know, you have, you know, they have put a camera on you and they have like three or four people that involved from the film and they just sort of like sort of surround you and you kind of feel very exposed and very vulnerable. And you do kind of hear their voices saying, do this, do that. What are you, what's this? And so, again, I just kind of like, it's more like that's how it feels. It feels like you're just out there exposed and you've got these sort of like godlike voices calling out to you and asking you things and being very, you know, judgmental. It feels like, you know, you're really out on a limb there. And so it was more like, you know, with the spotlight and everything, it was more like just trying to create an impression of that, about how you really feel really out there and exposed.
I know we haven't got to your film. We're going to get there. I just want to tarp on Mitch a bit more here. Do you think he has a sense of self-worth?
Yeah, you know, I feel like I kind of played it, and I did design the character to really show that I felt like he was very lacking in self-esteem and self-worth, and not just because he's not successful as an actor, but also the way at the same time he's obviously not successful, but the way he always projects, like he knows he likes to tell lay people all about the process of acting because it's the one way where he can feel like he kind of knows something maybe that other people don't know, and it makes him feel like it gives him some kind of meaning that he has very little in his own life as it is, you know?
Now, you start off the film with showing me a smoothie.
Yes.
And the smoothie doesn't pay off till about an hour later. And I think most people might even miss that and forget about the opening. Do you find that do people don't figure out the opening, what's going on?
I've never heard that because I think I you're right. That's exactly what I wanted to pick. I wanted to see if people could connect that later. But at the same time, I also thought, well, even if people don't connect it, it's sort of starting the visual process of like this person's life is about to go into a, you know, I figure I could look at it from the standpoint that it was symbolic that, you know, this innocent person was going to the airport and his life was, whether he knew it or not, was just about to be come into a blender. You know what I mean? Like, so I figure I had that double thing if they didn't pick up the original thing that you picked up on that. And I agree. Like, I think that, I don't know. It's interesting. Very few people have even brought that up except for yourself, which, you know, it does make me think about that, like how people really perceive that.
Yeah, I was just wondering. Okay, you do have a lot of music, and you do change your music a lot in the film. You have soft jazz music, which I wrote could maybe something different, and then your black and white scenes are something different. Where did that music come from, or what was your philosophy behind it?
I think really because, you know, like the film is sort of like, even though it's a buddy movie, and I was really influenced by the idea of like 1970s American buddy movies, or late 60s in the case of Midnight Cowboy and Odd Couple. But I also feel like it was also a chance for me to have fun and to kind of like look at different genres of movies that I like and different types of movies. So I kind of use the opportunity for Mitch's fantasies, where he's always thinking about movies, to kind of be able to indulge my own personal interest and love of different kinds of movies, whether they're comedies, musicals, you know, even some drama. There's some dramatic music, for instance, from time to time. So, and then of course a lot of Latin music, especially that's something I really love. And my wife is Latin as well. She's from Venezuela. So that was like a big influence in that as well. So, so I just feel like, you know, it was a real benefit for me to have the Mitch character constantly fantasize and see his life through movies, because that really did allow me to sort of to channel that interest that I have on screen about different movies.
I want to hammer you on one thing you didn't bring about the music. You were playing a tape at one point.
Yes.
That doesn't play a song. And I actually did want to hear that song at that time, but we hear that song later in the film.
That's right.
Would you like to comment on that song?
That song is by this fictitious punk group that Mitch is always bragging about called the Snotty Punks, that he thought was like the music of his youth. And, you know, for me, the big thing in the movie was I wanted, because Mitch was trying so hard to make the evening good and to be optimistic, and I wanted the evening also to be like a series of just, he's constantly frustrated. Every time he tries to do something good, it gets frustrated. So one of the things was, like, he's really excited about going to his old coffee shop, but it's totally changed, so he's frustrated. He's really excited about, hey, we're going to play, now that we're together, we can play the theme music for our adolescence. And then he puts it in the tape machine, and the tape machine jams. So it's like he's constantly living in this state where everything he tries to do that's good gets frustrated all the time.
I wanted to talk about who's singing that song.
Okay. I actually wrote that song, and some other people that were the cinematographer and the production designer, they all played on it. They're all musicians. So we recreated that song. We made up that song, and I sang it.
I know.
Oh, okay. As the sort of alias that they mentioned in the movie, who's a takeoff of Johnny Rotten, Johnny Snotnose.
Yeah, I know. That's why I'm bringing it up. You got to promote your own music.
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, you know what? I was hoping sometimes I think the Oscars, they're always, by the time they get to their third or fourth song for Best Original Song nominations, I told my wife Maria, I said, you know, we should actually see if we can get that song nominated, because I think when they get to that fourth or fifth song, sometimes they're reaching for music. So
it should work. Hey, you should have been out the year of the Muppets. They only had like two songs that year, the Muppet song and Captain America. Like, what was that about?
I feel bad about that. We should have given a qualifying run in L.A.
I think you should have. L.A. and New York, and you would have been fine.
Yeah, I think, you know what? I appreciate you saying that, because now it makes me realize that we should have done that. So, and thanks for bringing that up. And we had a lot of fun making that song. And we even made a video for that we put on our special features of the DVD, Blu-ray and DVD that we just released. We actually shot an actual video that was supposedly shot, that was taken from the early 80s, late 70s, of that song, Young, British, and Snotty. And we actually did a video, which is, it's on YouTube, but it's also on our special edition DVD as well.
And that's just, so far, listeners, if they're looking for it, it's called Young, British, and Snotty on YouTube?
Yeah.
The band?
By the Snotty Punks, yeah.
Perfect. Let's get it out there so everybody can find it.
Yeah,
so let's get back. You're an indie production.
Yep.
You need locations.
Yes.
So you have an airport location.
Yes.
You have an airport garage location. You have a coffee shop location. And you have an apartment location. Are pretty much the ones I want to go over.
Sure.
How'd you get your airport?
There actually is a small, in the Vancouver International Airport, there's the main terminal, and then there's what's called the south terminal, which is more like regular airline, like it flies normal airlines and planes on, but they're more local planes. So if you want to go all throughout, you know, BC, you want to fly up north, you want to go to Victoria from Vancouver, it's a smaller one, and it shuts down like about 10 o'clock at night. It's the south terminal. And so we actually, that was the one location that actually cost us, we had to pay to get it for one night. We filmed that whole airport scene in one night there when they closed down from 10 in the morning till about 6 in the morning, 10 at night until 6 in the morning. And that one we had to pay. Like, they have a regular thing that Hollywood productions, when they come to Vancouver, TV productions, they actually have like a, you know, an office that takes film projects, but you do have to pay. So that was the one location that actually really cost us. We had to pay for that one.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
So let's go on. We have a coffee shop location, which I do want to talk about the coffee shop just after. How'd you get that location?
That actually was a coffee shop in Vancouver, again, that we approached them, and for two nights we filmed there. Luckily, it was a coffee shop that actually closed at 6 o'clock at night. So we were able to get in there. I know it's weird. It's a restaurant coffee shop. They actually close at 6 p.m. So we actually would get in there right at 6 and film until about 4 in the morning, back-to-back nights.
So let's go back to that for a second. What is cinnamon coffee?
That actually is something that when I was just out of high school, I grew up in Winnipeg. And we used to go late at night. We'd go to the bar or we'd go somewhere. And then we would go to this – there was this one late-night coffee shop, kind of a pub, kind of a place, a cafe called the Club Blue Note in Winnipeg. And they actually had, when you ordered coffee, the coffee was already flavored as cinnamon in the coffee. And it was like people flocked there for that.
I've never heard of that in my life, to say.
No, I know. It's crazy, but that is true.
Let's discuss your third location, your apartment location. Whose apartment did you steal?
Well, when they go to the apartment that, you know, we filmed like an old building in downtown Vancouver, one of the historic parts, in the hallways and the stairways and all that. And then when we got inside, when you go inside near the end of the movie, sort of the climax of the movie, when Mitch and Dunk get confronted by these very unusual female situation, that was a set. We built that.
Oh, really?
Was all built. We rented a studio and we spent 24 hours completely building what we call the revolutionary bordello scene.
I had no idea. It did not look like a set. I wasn't sure. I thought it was just a big room that you were using.
Yeah, it was all built. It was from nothing, everything.
Don't take this the wrong way, but I noticed all the women in your film were attractive.
Yes.
Now, was that a plan? Not to have any, but I guess normal-looking people? I mean, they're all pretty, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, you're right, and that was a plan because, again, when I mentioned earlier about the character of Mitch, that he's constantly, you know, frustrated in his attempts to find any kind of, like, to get any satisfaction about anything, whether this is reunion or any, you know, an acting situation. And I wanted a situation where he was constantly encountering all these women. I wanted it to be very almost surreal, very Fellini-esque, where it's almost he's encountering all – it's almost exaggerated that he's encountering all these beautiful women. But the one thing that is in common is all these beautiful women are either ignoring him or reminding him that of his foibles or the things – again, that are reinforcing the frustration. So he finds these women at the airport. They're very beautiful, and they call him over. He gets excited, and they say – and then he hears one of them say, oh, maybe this old guy can take our picture, right? And so right away it's sort of like it's deflating, right? The idea is like it's like he's in the circumference of all this beauty, and it's almost a reminder that he's really not a successful person, and it kind of reinforces his lack of self-esteem.
So let's discuss the photo scene. The case says, I heart big dicks.
Yes.
Where do you find that phone case?
Again, yeah, the art department, that was we built that. Yeah, we designed that. Yeah.
See, you don't think I'd notice these things, do you? I do pay attention.
Yeah, you do. I have to say, you are in the upper echelon of people who have noticed a lot of the sophisticated things in the film there.
I want to discuss the parking scene to your car. Beautiful car.
Yes.
Whose car?
I had to, you know what, I thought I could borrow it. It was about 2 days before filming. I thought that'd be no problem just getting an old car. I'm in Vancouver. There's all these old car places that supply for cars for movies, whatever. And I was shocked. But a day before the movie, I couldn't get a car from anybody. Because then people said, well, what, you know, then there was a problem with the insurance. If I took their car for a day, they were worried about insurance and whatever. And so then I had to basically have to buy that car.
You had to buy the car?
At the buy it, I paid about like almost like $1,800 for that car because it really wasn't in great working condition. So we could just barely drive it to the locations. And even when we were driving at all the scenes at night where they're driving, it was like really like we did that. And then it was like we had to get the car back like to my garage, and it just kept leaking oil. And yeah, and it kept breaking down and the brake. So and once we were wrapped with that car, I ended up selling it for $300.
Wow, so you took a loss on the car.
Take it off my hands because I was parking it at my apartment building, and then the superintendents were complaining that it was leaking oil, so that I was so desperate to sell it, like I almost gave it away. So I took a huge loss, but I knew I needed an old car you know, that was an old beater that would kind of sort of like symbolize Mitch's journey through life, that he somehow was constantly getting beat up and whatever. So he needed kind of a good signature car for his character.
I do have to agree with Dunk in that one scene. Where did you park? Because you're the only guy there.
Yeah, I know. That's another example of like what I was trying to go for. That like from the minute he like leaves the airport, it's almost like it's like a series of real events, but also could be viewed as sort of surreal. And I was really looking for this idea that his car, yeah, like there's this huge, giant, empty parking lot at an airport, and yet he's parked so far away that I was trying to create this really crazy, surreal idea that his car was like literally in the middle of nowhere. To kind of reinforce to people that what you're about to see was going to be somewhat crazy. You know what I mean?
I do have two comments Mitch makes. Mitch says, talks about Magic Mike and no nudity. I 100% agree with Mitch. That was ridiculous. Is that a personal opinion, or do you think that's Mitch's opinion?
It's something that I noticed, and that it was very easy to transcribe that to the character of Mitch. You know, it's funny now you're making me realize, just talking to you, that when I said earlier on that it was sort of this whole thing had nothing to do with me or my life and it was all made up, the more I talk about all these little things, it does seem like a lot of it tends to be coming from some kind of real experiences or thoughts. So actually, you know what? I might have to reassess that. I think there's probably more going on there than I kind of realized in terms of memories of my own life.
And do you like Marathon Man?
I love Marathon Man.
I say I have to call you out because you did bring it up.
I'm a huge fan. I read the book by William Goldman. I've seen the movie. I love it.
Now, Belgian waffles, have you ever had them?
I've never had Belgian waffles, no.
Because you do talk about it. So I was like, he's never had Belgian waffles, and I'm going to call that out on it. Yeah, it's one thing I've never found in Canada. I've looked forever for them. So I'm just wondering, did you have Belgian waffles? So continue on with your film. I do notice one minor quibble, and you can just take this for what it is. When you're at the end scene, the leader of the women group,
right,
his cigar is not lit. Was it ever lit?
It was lit.
Later on when she burns the photo, but when she first comes in the room, she pretends she's smoking it all the time.
Yeah, no, it wasn't lit. It was supposed to be an affectation or whatever, because we were worried that if we lit it too soon in the studio, it was going to set off
smoke alarm.
The smoke alarm and even the sprinkler systems, it was going to wipe out our whole set. So we literally waited until like almost the last scene to light that thing, just so we didn't get our sets wiped out with all the water coming out of the sprinkler systems. We were actually concerned about that.
And I do have one other minor quibble. Near the end of the film, Mitch has a chance to leave.
Yes.
Why is he stopped to pick up his stuff? Shouldn't he just go?
He should go, but I think part of it was probably because he was so fixated throughout the night about his audition. Like he had to go get his audition stuff or whatever.
That's the way I took it.
Yeah.
And where did you come up with the gag? Because we have to know how Dunk convinced him to go in.
Right.
And you finally show us. So where did that come from?
That was kind of like I wanted to do, like you said, like a running gag at the beginning where Mitch was so happy to have his old friend back. He wanted to do his signature moves and things that, you know, goofy little salutations and things that you know, you do when you're, you know, the way you high five or something. You might have your own way of doing it. And he kept denying that from him all the time. Like when they go into the coffee, he's like, no, I'm not going to do this. And then, of course, another disappointment for Mitch. So then I thought, you know, because Mitch is constantly the almost like this adolescent person in an adult body, I thought, of course, like what would it be that you know, in a pivotal moment like that Dunk could promise Mitch that Mitch would love, right? And it's like, of course, you know, it would be that he would allow him to do once again to do their signature hand clap or whatever, you know, their little silly move, right? So, and I thought like that probably would be the only thing that would get him in there, right? Because it's just like that would complete in Mitch's mind, that would complete the idea that he's really back with his friend again, and they've really sealed their reunion with that kind of a thing. So that's kind of why I thought of that.
I do have one last thing. What's the true relationship between Mitch and Duncan in real life?
Well, no, like we're friends, and he's actually a filmmaker and an actor, and we met in a scene study class. And I remember telling him that I had this idea for this film, and the more I got to know him, we did scene studies together, and I thought, oh, you know what, he'd be a good foil for me. You know, we look different, so it has that kind of throwback feel, where almost like a Laurel and Hardy thing or something, which reinforces the differences. And then about a year later, I said, look, I actually wrote that role for you. And he said, oh my God, you did? And so I gave it to him, we talked about it, and then we just became friends. I acted in some of his productions, and, you know, so... We were actually friends through the scene study before we actually went ahead and did the movie. And he was really good about doing the movie because we shot that over 6 months, and the whole film takes place in one night. So like he kept saying, "Well, I would like to go to Mexico and stuff," and I kept saying, "No, you can't go to Mexico because you're going to come back with a tan and whatever."
So you stopped him from going to Mexico? That's not fair.
No, I know. I just like he'd say, well, I have this role maybe that I want to do, but I have to cut my hair and all this. I said, look, so I have to really give him props. Like he, for 6 months or whatever, he kept his look.
Wow.
I know. That's crazy. I mean, I guess obviously, you know, if he would have got offered a role in some major TV show or something, I'm sure he would have had to say, look, I'm sorry, I have to cut my hair. And we would have had to figure that out or something. Right. So,
well, you could have added a scene for some reason.
You're right. I could have had a scene at the bordel scene where they forcibly shave his head.
Yeah, or something. You would have had the opportunity.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
I always want to discuss catering because you're a small production.
Yes.
How do you feed your crew?
Yeah, you know, we you know, Maria, you know, my wife, she's the producer. She was also the art director, costume designer. She took care of that. She had a lot of people, like we really use a lot of people in the Latin community here in Vancouver. And she had a lot of friends as well that she knew that were like really good. They did some catering and things like that. So she was able to really tap in to some of those people so we always made sure we had, you know, a lot of food, you know, like in a real indie production, you know, you can't always pay people that much. So, you know, it really is about like, you really got to pamper them with the catering and the, you know, and the goods and the coffee. And so that's how we did it. We just did it, you know, we just did it like just with people we knew.
Now, the more we've talked about your film, this is my final question before we get to fun questions. Do you feel that this is your homage to 9 1/2 by Fellini?
Yeah, you know what? I wanted it to be like a very Fellini-esque. I felt like my log line was like, or was like The Odd Couple via Fellini. Like if I was disappointed about one thing, when I look at the film, I think I should have really doubled down on more of the oddness and more of the Fellini-esque sort of surreal feel to things. And I think I really should have, like, I don't know how that would have went for people. Like if people would have thought maybe it was an odd mix for a buddy movie, but I kind of, those were the parts I think that I really liked the most, like putting in the movie where things, happened that were not necessarily explainable. Like we have that chauffeur scene where like the chauffeur is at the beginning of the movie and then inexplicably the chauffeur shows up later on. Those are the kinds of things that I kind of like that. Those are the things I wish I would have like increased the amount of things I put in the film like that.
One last thing I thought you could have done, that you could have had Mitch walk out of the shower and go, I can't wait to see Doug tonight. And had it always a dream sequence.
Yeah. No, you're right. I mean, that's another thing too. I wish I would have put more of those dream sequences, the fantasy sequences, because we had a lot of fun. It's just that those were like, for how long they lasted, it was amazing how much work. Like, for instance, the little dance scenes, like we even, you know, took choreography for like a week before we did those scenes, stuff. Like, it was shocking, like, for how long you see it in the movie. Like those little fantasy scenes, it took so much work as far as, you know, making sure we had the right sets and the costumes for things that lasted like 10 seconds. It was, I would like to do more of that, but there were just like little mini movies in themselves that were like so, like, I thought they'd be fun and be like quickie things to do, but they took so much planning. Even our little homage to Jack Nicholson and in Five Easy Pieces, like we had to, I mean, just that took so much work to try to mimic that scene, you know, so.
One last question. Where did your wife find Mitch's ugly jacket?
That was amazing. I went through my dad's stuff, and I found the odd stuff that I liked, but it didn't fit properly. And then Maria was just looking at some secondhand shops here in Vancouver, and she saw that, and she came home. She said, look, I put this thing on consignment. You got to come down and look at it. I think I could have found Mitch. And so I went with her, and it fit perfectly. I looked at it. I felt like Cinderella putting on the glass shoe or whatever that fit perfectly. And I said, you know what? You know, Quentin Tarantino always says, you know what? Like, the character comes alive during the costume fitting. And when I put that jacket on, that was probably one of the first times I actually could start to see things like Mitch. So she found it, actually, just off the rack.
Huh, there you go. Okay, it's time for fun questions, which I'm sure you've prepped immensely for.
Sure.
Favorite movie?
Apocalypse Now.
Wow. Do you ever have to explain that to people, that film?
It's just one of those big, crazy, bold movies where, like, I feel like he had a director that didn't know if he was ever going to make another movie, so he just threw everything he had at the screen.
I will agree with you 100%. Your favorite food?
Pasta.
Okay. And your favorite season?
Fall.
Fair enough. Tell everybody where they can find your film.
Our film's available on Legacy of Wine. It's available on iTunes, Amazon Prime, Google Play, and it's available on Amazon.com and Amazon.ca as a download, and also now available for purchase on special edition DVD and Blu-ray.
Now, what do we have in store for the future for you?
My wife, Maria, again, who is my producer, we're actually finishing a short right now, and then we're in pre-production for another feature.
Awesome. Thank you for your time.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for doing this. I really appreciate it. Thanks for your support.
No problem. Bye-bye.
Take care. Thank you.
Hey, I just want to say thank you for listening to this great interview. We have more on our website at www.extrafeatures.ca, and if you enjoyed it, can you please go to iTunes and leave us an iTunes review and like us on our Facebook page? Thank you.